better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country tis of thee. I eat for social.
Support for Mouthful on KRCB Santa Rosa comes from our members and from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86NETBOOKS. Also from Traverso's Gourmet Foods and Wine, a family-owned purveyor serving customers for over 85 years with domestic and imported edibles and beverages in an old-world atmosphere. In downtown Santa Rosa and online at traversos.com.
Well, good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan, and this show is actually being pre-recorded so that I can bring you a guest that actually can't be here live in the studio on Sundays. But, you know, being in the studio on a different day is the next best thing. So I would like to welcome the author of a new book, Jen Lin Liu. Is that right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, good. And you have a new book called Serve the People, A Stir-Fried Journey Through China. And it's just out and it looks like a combination memoir slash tale along with recipes.
Yes, it's about my food experiences in China, learning how to cook in an old cooking school in a traditional neighborhood of Beijing, and then going on to intern in a number of restaurants, which then led to the opening of my own cooking school in Beijing.
Now, what led you to take those initial classes?
Well, I had been in China for about 4 years before I started cooking school, and I was working as a journalist, covering things not related to food at all, in fact. That was the furthest thing from my mind when I moved to China. I wanted to be a hard-hitting Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, but then I discovered that food just started taking over my life in a way. It's such an important part of the culture. It's a nation of foodies. China is a nation of foodies. And I realized it was a part of the culture that I could really relate to, that I could understand, different from karaoke or Peking opera, which I have no interest in. So food was something that I found very accessible and something that I could talk to with anyone. So that made it a very appealing topic to study.
Had there been in your childhood or in your past before you got to Beijing, had there been a lot of Chinese cuisine, a lot that was familiar?
Well, my parents are Chinese immigrants. They grew up in Taiwan and then moved to America. And they brought, you know, some of the traditions of what they grew up with to San Diego, where I grew up. And unfortunately, cooking wasn't something that was emphasized when I was a child. My parents had very high hopes that I would go on to an Ivy League school and become a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so cooking was something that was not emphasized. They were also very busy professionals. So they didn't emphasize cooking. They never taught me how to cook. They didn't cook much themselves. And food is often, the job of a chef is often seen in Chinese parents' eyes as being something that you would do if you didn't have another choice in life.
It hasn't attained the sort of status that it has in the United States
in
recent years. So how did they respond when they saw you going down that avenue?
Well, it had been a long struggle because I first became a journalist and, you know, they weren't happy with that. And then I went to China, which they also weren't happy with because they said, well, here's a country that we've been trying to get out of our whole lives. And there you go, going back to a place that we wanted to leave. So it was, you know, a struggle. But now I think they're very pleased that I'm, you know, I found my own way. Mm-hmm. And my dad has even attended my cooking school in Beijing. So I think he's quite proud, even though he does go around these days still saying, well, Jen is really good at mathematics. She really is.
Well, you have to be good at math to be good at running any sort of food operation.
That's right.
Certainly a cooking school. There's a lot of that involved.
Lots of numbers.
Yes. So tell me about the school.
It's called Black Sesame Kitchen, and it really just developed out of all these adventures. I never thought I would open a cooking school or be in the restaurant industry. It is such a grueling life, mm-hmm. of course. And I ended up going into it because after I interned in a number of restaurants, friends of mine just started asking me in Beijing, where can I learn to do that myself? And so I started going to my friends' homes and cooking there for them. And that led to me finding a space of my own and setting up a little kitchen where I have my mentors, in fact, my Chairman Wong, my cooking teacher from the cooking school that I originally attended, and my mentor, my noodle chef mentor, Chef Zong, is also a part of the school. He teaches there, too.
Mm-hmm. And do you operate the school year-round? Are you just on a brief visit here from Beijing?
I am on a two-month vacation from Beijing right now. So the school does run pretty much year-round, and we do one-off classes where you can just go in for a day class. And we also have wine dinners. We combine home-style Chinese cuisine with imported wine.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So these are classes for what we would call the home cook, not for professional cooks.
That's right, home cooks. Mm-hmm. Home cooks who come over and are visiting China, or friends of mine who live in Beijing and other foreigners who live there.
Okay, mm-hmm. So they're taught in English?
Yep, they're taught in English, mm-hmm. and we always have somebody who can speak English there. Generally, it's me or one of my assistants. And so we really dispel the difficulties in making Chinese food. It seems very mysterious to a lot of people, but in fact, it isn't. Once you know a few of the basics, you can pretty much experiment with a lot of different ingredients.
Mm-hmm. What are the most important basics?
Well, the most important basics you would need to know are some of the spices and sauces. Most dishes contain leek, ginger, and garlic. Those are sort of the trifecta mm-hmm. of Chinese ingredients that make up the base of any dish. And, of course, you'll need cooking oil. You would need soy sauce. You would need some vinegar. You would need cooking wine. And essentially, those are the main ingredients. And then there are some spices that figure into different cuisines, such as Sichuan peppercorns mm-hmm. for Sichuanese food, or dried chili peppers, which is in Sichuanese food and also other cuisines. And sugar actually is quite important. Sugar is commonly used in main entrees, mm-hmm. Sort of a counterbalance to the salt and pepper that you would put in the food.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about heat? One of the things that I've always figured would limit me if I wanted to pursue real Chinese cooking was the fact that the flames of domestic stoves in the United States they're not enough BTUs. Is that an accurate observation?
You can still do Chinese cooking. You just have to wait for the oil to heat up longer. So as long as you keep your wok on the stove at the highest temperature possible and add some oil in there and let it heat up for a mm-hmm. while, then you'd be okay.
Okay, so you just mm-hmm. you maybe can't cook quite as fast with high heat.
Right.
You just have to wait a little longer.
It takes longer.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Because yeah. that high heat, fast cooking in a wok, is that a signature technique?
That is a signature technique. I would also say that you would have to be prepared for your house to smell like a Chinese kitchen. The problem with a lot, well, not the problem, but I guess the delightful thing about Chinese cuisine is that a lot of it is deep fried in oil first and then put through a cooking process. And they like to basically cut up their meats or vegetables and then basically flash fry them in a mm-hmm. hot oil first so that the meat or vegetables are very juicy, retain a lot of the flavor. And then they're stir-fried with some different sauces as mm-hmm. well. So that process of deep frying, of course, will smell up your kitchen with oil.
Mm-hmm. You know, if it makes good food, that's okay with me. What about noodles? I know you have a whole chapter in the book devoted to noodles. It's called Noodle Intern. And I think that one of the really great trends to have finally arrived in the United States is noodle houses of all sorts. So can you talk a little bit about that aspect?
Sure. Noodles were not so familiar to me when I moved to China because I was raised by Southern Chinese parents. And in Southern China, the cuisine is very focused around rice as a staple, whereas in the north of China, they are really focused on grains and wheats. So you get a lot more noodles in northern China. You get a lot more dumplings in northern China. Mm-hmm. And I ended up as a noodle intern in a small stall in a very far away part of Beijing that I wasn't familiar with because after I had graduated from the cooking school, I could not find an internship anywhere. Nobody wanted to hire a foreigner to work in their kitchen. They didn't understand why I wanted to go into their kitchen and work. It was simply not something that they could see a foreigner doing. Mm-hmm. And so finally, I found this noodle chef through a friend of a friend, and he allowed me to go in basically because he didn't have time to say no. He was so busy making his noodles, mm-hmm. and he had to make 600 bowls of noodles a day to break even.
Wow, that's a lot of noodles.
Yes, and the price of his noodles was about the equivalent of 30, 40 cents a bowl. So it was a very grueling process of making these noodles. And what was amazing to me was he was such an artisan. His name is Chef Zhang, and he actually cooks at my cooking school now. He would just treat every bowl as if he was, you know, an artisan making, you know, it depended on the customer. If they wanted thicker noodles, he would give them thicker noodles. If mm-hmm. If they wanted thinner ones, he would make them thin. And the care that he took in making those bowls of noodles, even though he had to make 600 of them, was absolutely amazing.
And what is the traditional way of serving noodles? Is it in a broth, as you might see, say, in Vietnamese-style noodles?
Well, there can be broth-based noodles, and mm-hmm. there are often also stir-fried noodles. Mm-hmm. And what's great about noodles in China is they come in all sorts of shapes and varieties. There's everything from small postage-sized pieces of noodle to long, thin strands that are hand-pulled to the knife-grated variety that I made, which was basically taking a big hunk of dough, holding it up about chest high, and then you would take a big razor blade-like knife and shave them into a boiling vat of water. And that's what I did in the noodle shop that I worked at.
And what sort of size noodle would that
result
in? So
you would result in sort of a fettuccine.
Oh, okay. And
kind
long
of a
like a fettuccine. Okay.
Yeah, long ribbons of noodles. Okay. And they were so delicious. They were very chewy. Basically just made from flour and water. Mm-hmm. And the sauces that we would make to accompany them were an eggplant-based sauce, and also a pork belly-based sauce.
Mm, tell me about the pork belly.
Oh, mm-hmm. The pork belly is great. It's basically a pork belly that's red braised, which is a process of caramelizing mm-hmm. it with sugar, soy sauce, and water. And then adding some star anise, some peppercorns, some bay leaf, just to give it a very hearty flavor. And then that is basically smothered on top of the noodles that are made. And then you basically cut up and garnish some cucumbers and some parsley and add a little bit of vinegar, and you've got a delicious, delicious lunch or dinner.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
I could use
absolutely
some
delicious.
Right now. That sounds really wonderful.
So there's
I love
a recipe
that
in the book
belly.
For that.
Oh, there
so,
is.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So after the noodle internship, what was next?
After I did the noodles, I ended up working in a dumpling house. Dumplings are a specialty of Beijing, and they are very different from the ones you get here. I mean, it was incredible to me to do the whole dumpling dough from scratch to make the wrappers. And I was working in a restaurant that basically made tens of thousands of dumplings a day of all different stuffings, including some really interesting combinations like cabbage and peanut. We also had something that had pork, shrimp, and tofu in it. And what I learned is that you can actually stuff a dumpling with anything you want.
Anything. And so what's really signature about it is the type of dough and the execution
of the dough.
And
also they often eat them with raw garlic in Beijing, and also a vinegar dipping sauce with chili oil.
So vinegar, chili oil. I love vinegar
garlic.
And garlic. I love those dipping sauces. I think they're absolutely wonderful.
No soy sauce, actually. Very, very little soy sauce in Chinese, in that style of cooking.
That's very, okay, interesting. Where does where does salt come from in a dish? Actual salt?
The salts in the dish?
I mean, because in some dishes, you apply salt with soy sauce or fish sauce. And so I'm wondering the source of salt in this area.
Oh, you would blend it in with the filling.
So you would use actual salt?
Yeah.
Actual crushed salt. Okay. Then you have another chapter in the book called, well, actually, I want to go in order.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about fine dining, because I know that if I have friends who come back from, say, Hong Kong or various parts, they will talk about that high-end level of Chinese dining that I think, for the most part, we don't see very much of in the United States. They go, let's do Chinese takeout, let's go to the noodle house. But that other element, I think, is still largely undiscovered.
Yeah, I think it's and it has been undiscovered in China even for a while because of course, the poverty that was very prevalent in China for decades now. And now, finally, China is becoming more developed and the economy is really taking off. And so, of course, people are dining in all sorts of new ways that they didn't, or in ways that didn't exist for the past 50 years with communism.
So is that style of dining drawing on the past and drawing, say, from how royals dined perhaps, or is it a new invention?
I would say there's two strains of that. One strain would be, like you said, sort of the emperor style of dining. There is a trend of you know, serving the food that they ate during the Qing Dynasty. I actually think that food is not as interesting as some of the newer stuff that's going on with chefs. I write about a chef in Shanghai named Jeremy Lung, who's opened up a restaurant called the Wanpoa Club. I go and intern there, and he is making traditional Shanghainese food, but adding new ingredients, things such as foie gras, ingredients that didn't exist in China about a decade ago, and also creating new Western presentation styles to go along with that. And also, you know, doing wine pairings and incorporating Western styles of eating with Chinese food.
Now, I was talking to a fisherman out in Bodega Bay, and at the height of Dungeness crab season, which is in the winter here, he was shipping about 2,000 pounds of Dungeness crab a week to China. So are you seeing more and more Western ingredients coming?
Yes, we're at the local market near my home. You can get lobsters from South Africa, fish from Chile, you know, an amazing assortment of garuba from Australia. So it's really opening up. And I think they're so fascinated. Chinese are so fascinated by the variety of food they can now get that there really hasn't been this idea of local cuisine yet. You know, I think they're expanding beyond their boundaries and probably going through what America did a few decades ago without realizing, of course, that there are consequences to importing your fish from South Africa.
Yeah. Plus traditions that, you know, they'll rediscover after a couple of decades of doing what they're doing. They'll begin to then to go back to their roots and discover those roots, I would think.
Right.
Now, is this this trend happening for both home cooks and restaurant cooks, or is it more a chef's movement?
I think it's more in the restaurants, this new style of cooking. People eat out all the time in China. It's just a nation of eaters who go out for a meal, because you can really get full on anything from about 25 cents to, you know, $300. It just depends on how much money you want to spend. And so it's not prohibitively expensive, and it's very common to go out so much, in fact, that, you know, even Chinese New Year dinners, which were traditionally eaten at home, are now eaten out in restaurants, and people are afraid that they're losing the tradition of home-cooked meals, which I actually think are the best meals that I've had, the home-cooked meals.
I completely agree with that, and I hate to see that sort of switching of ideas about where the best food is. I still believe that the best food needs to be made in home kitchens because that's how it's passed on.
That's right.
So in the restaurants, I imagine, and I have not been to China, but
you
I always...
You should come and visit.
I would love to. I always imagine China as having lots and lots of street food and stall food and that sort of thing. Please tell me I'm right.
Oh, yes, they do. They do. Uh-huh. Much more so in Shanghai. Shanghai's got a wide variety of street food that is just so amazing. It's just, you know, you walk down the street and you're just bombarded by different food smells. And it was really in Shanghai when I was living there from 2001 to 2004. That's when I really fell in love with food for the first time in my life. Mm-hmm. I had actually never really, you know, I had lived in New York City and that's a real foodie destination and everything. But I had never really thought about food so much until I moved to Shanghai and just really discovered that it was just in your face all the time. And it was everything ranging from pan-fried pork dumplings, which are these dumplings that are basically grilled on this giant wok that's about the size of a truck tire and basically with a nice crispy bottom because they're grilled with a lot of oil, mm-hmm. and sprinkled with a little bit of black sesame and scallions and served with vinegar. Mm. And when you bite into them, the juice just gushes everywhere. You know, you have to kind of be prepared to wear a bib or something when you eat these.
It sounds like a really, really good pot sticker.
Oh, they're so amazing. They're better than pot stickers. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're just absolutely amazing. And then there is also lamb skewers are actually very common Chinese street food. It's sort of like the hot dog of China. Mm-hmm. You just walk down the street and often there's a Muslim Chinese man sprinkling some cumin onto these lamb skewers that are then grilled over an open charcoal fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when it comes to meats, what are the ones that are used? You know, you do hear, oh, I don't know about eating meat in China. I'm afraid I might eat something I wouldn't really want. So what are the most common, you know, sort of staple meats that
Well, the most common meat in China is pork. Basically, 60 to 70.
And you've got to love that.
Oh, yeah. We love pork. Love pork. 60 to 70% of the meat you're going to find in China is pork. Nothing, nothing more exotic than pork, really, you know. And they use, what's interesting about meats in China is they use every single part of the animal, everything from, you know, the pig head to the pigtail.
Yeah, and the feet.
And the feet.
Absolutely.
I love chicken feet now. I actually was quite put off by them when I first moved to China. But there's something about they love the fact that the skin to meat ratio is very high, so that you can get a lot of chewy bits.
I ate them for the first time in Malaysia. I love them.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, they're for me, they were an acquired taste, but now I really enjoy them.
The fingernails can be a little disconcerting.
Yeah. And I've had them all sorts of ways, braised, grilled on a stick. Even
chicken feet on a stick. That's great. Now, what about beef? Do you see much beef?
There is beef. It is actually more expensive to buy beef in northern China than, say, lamb. Lamb is, or I guess it'd be more accurate to say mutton is much more common than beef. And lamb is very plentiful in northern China, and often it's cut into very thin slices and then boiled in a hot pot, a Chinese style of fondue, where you have a boiling pot of water at your dining table, and then you throw in some lamb, you throw in some vegetables, and then you make a delicious sesame dipping sauce that you then take the cooked meat and vegetables out of and dip it in
the
before
sauce.
You eat.
Sounds
really delicious.
Sounds really good. There doesn't seem, from what I can tell, much of a dairy industry or many dairy products at all. You don't see Chinese cheeses. You don't read about milk being used much, butter.
Well, what's interesting now is there's a whole movement of dairy in China. I've heard that part of the reason why dairy prices are going up in the world is because Chinese are starting to drink a lot of milk now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you do see that in the markets, that they love feeding milk to their kids because, of course, they think it really helps them, you know, grow, and all the calcium is very good for children, of course. And actually, there are regions of China where they do eat cheese. In southwest China, they have a delicious goat cheese that they basically slice and pan fry, and it's absolutely delicious. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Butter is not so common, and I think oil really takes the place of butter in Chinese cooking.
Mm-hmm. I should tell you, my guest is Jen Lin Liu. Her book, Serve the People, A Stir-Fried Journey Through China. We'll be right back with more talk with Jen. So you're a New York girl.
I went to school in New York.
Mm-hmm. Ended up in Beijing, and you're going to stay there for the most part. Is that right?
I am for now. Uh-huh. My fiancé is also a journalist based there, also an American from Boston.
He's based there as well.
Yeah, he lives in Beijing as well.
I know, so. You said you were getting married soon. Getting married in San Diego?
We are getting married in San Diego next month, yes. And then we'll head over to Hawaii for a couple of weeks.
Oh, where are you going in Hawaii?
Kauai and Big Island.
Oh, Mouthful loves Hawaii. We have done many, many shows on Hawaii, and I am extremely fond of the Big Island in particular.
It's
an absolutely, it's one of the most magical places on the planet, I think. So I hope you have a wonderful time there. How long were you involved in your cooking explorations before you decided to write the book?
Well, I always knew there was a story in it when I started to focus on food writing. And, it just came about bit by bit as I was going through cooking school. And as a journalist, of course, I've always taken notes on everything I do. And with the hope of writing a book, I had always hoped about writing a book. And mm-hmm. this just presented itself as the perfect topic because I could explore so much of China through its food. You know, I think one of the best compliments I've gotten about the book is that you can hate Chinese food but still love the book.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting.
Because it tells really the story of China, and it's a story beyond food.
Mm-hmm. Which I always think makes for the best. The very best food books are books that have food as sort of a tangent or sort of a current that runs under it. But what we're really talking about or should be talking about when we're talking about food is people and community and the way we connect to each other, which leads me to how do Chinese people eat? Is there much eating alone? Is there much eating in the car? You know, somebody...
Absolutely not.
I didn't think
absolutely
so.
Absolutely not. And in fact, McDonald's is starting to put drive-thrus in, and ooh, they have found that this is not successful.
Oh, well, good.
Even with the growing number of cars in China. Mm-hmm. But it is not a culture of eating alone. It is really difficult to eat alone, in fact. And I write restaurant reviews, and so from time to time, I do have to go out for a meal by mm-hmm. myself.
Now, who do you write them for?
I write them for Time Out Beijing.
Oh, Time Out.
And I've
Time
also written
Beijing, yes.
for Savour and some other great food magazines. And you're just really ostracized when you go to a restaurant alone. It is kind of an unpleasant experience because waitresses will stare at you and giggle and wonder, why are you there alone? There's not really a bar that mm-hmm. you can sit at and read a magazine and eat at the same time. For Chinese, eating is really a social phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You do it with lots of friends. Often there are private rooms where you get all restaurants in China, nearly all restaurants have private rooms mm-hmm. for you to be able to go in there with your friends, eat and drink as much as you please, perhaps even do a little karaoke on the side while you're eating.
Oh my goodness.
So eating is definitely a very social activity.
Mm-hmm. What about alcohol? What are the attitudes towards alcohol there?
They're starting to drink wine nowadays, mm-hmm. but for the most part, they really stick to their own Chinese alcohol. It's mm-hmm. called baijiu, and that means white alcohol. It's a grain alcohol that is very high proof, about 40, I think, oh, okay. 40 proof. And more than that, 40% alcohol.
Okay, 80 proof.
80 proof.
Yeah.
80 proof. And it's basically a grain alcohol that is distilled very similar to vodka, and they just do shots of it, shot after shot.
Oh, so you probably stay up late. Is it another country of sleep-deprived people? I see that in Spain. You know, everyone stays up really late, everyone eats really late, everyone drinks a lot, and then they get up early in the morning, and I don't know how they exist. I really don't know how they continue week after week at that pace.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So you've been a restaurant critic. You are a restaurant critic. You might be able to solve the menu mystery. There's always talk here, certainly in California, certainly in Northern California, about you go to a Chinese restaurant and you look at the menu and you know that what you're eating isn't what the Chinese guy at the table next to you is eating. And there's lots of chat on how do you get that? How do you get the stuff that you can't read about if you don't know Chinese?
Well, what's really funny is I feel like Chinese do have this attitude, even if they do live here in the States, that foreigners will only eat certain things, you know,
Sure.
And I've even experienced this now planning my rehearsal dinner at a Chinese restaurant. And, you know, I've gone to the restaurant with my parents and, you know, my fiance is a Caucasian American. And my parents will say things like, do you think they're going to eat that? I feel like, you know, you really can't discount the diner, that you really should, you know, put the things out there that they will eat, mm-hmm. that you will eat.
That you would like them to eat.
Really, you know, don't underestimate what people are capable of eating.
Yeah, there seems to be that attitude. I've gotten mm-hmm. it a lot when I've traveled, and I knew when I was in Malaysia for the first time, especially when I was in Malaysian Borneo. They kept trying to take me to Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's. They finally said, I don't eat these foods in America. Why would I eat them here? I want to eat what you eat. And once they realized I was being honest in what I said, oh, they had so much fun showing me so many of their favorite foods, and I just love it. I fell in love with Malaysian food, but it really took some pushing to get them to take me seriously.
I think it just illustrates the divide between Chinese culture and cultures outside of what Chinese know. Mm-hmm. For example, when Chinese travel overseas, often in tour groups, they do not eat anything but Chinese food. And I mean, I find uh-huh. that amazing when, you know, Chinese friends of mine will go to France or Italy and they'll come back and I ask them, how's the food? And they said, we don't know. We just had Chinese food the whole time. And yeah. that just baffles me.
So they're not the kind of traveler who goes to eat other food, which is a lot of the reason I like to travel, is to see how other people
yeah,
feed themselves.
You know, it is amazing. I think it's a country where they take a lot of pride in Chinese food, and they can be often a bit too proud of what they eat mm-hmm. at the expense of trying other things. Mm-hmm. And they see things like McDonald's as being a novelty, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, I'm with them on that.
Yeah. But, you know, it's McDonald's is, interestingly enough, a date place in China.
Really? Wow.
Big Friday night at McDonald's.
Interesting. Have you had a chance to do any interest, actually, in exploring the teas of China?
Yes, I absolutely love the teas. I mean, I've been a diehard coffee drinker growing up in the States, and I've really been introduced to the pleasure of tea in the past few years. And what's great about tea is you feel great drinking it, especially after a really greasy, heavy Chinese meal. Mm-hmm. And they feel that it counters the grease and oil that sometimes can come with Chinese food. And you may start and your meal with a nice Longjing green tea, which has a little bit of caffeine and kind of, you know, revs you up a little bit. And then they may end it with a pu'er tea.
Pu'er. I love the pu'er teas of China.
Yeah, they're very woody, smoked mm-hmm. flavors. Or an oolong tea, which has a nice, it's an aid in digestion. Mm-hmm. So those are two very common teas in mm-hmm. China.
And when you say that they see tea as sort of counterbalancing the fat, the richness, it seems that one layer of Chinese food in general is looking at those qualities. I always love the idea that, you know, there's cooling foods and warming foods. And
oh,
that
yes,
sort of thing.
The whole concept.
Could you talk
of that.
A little bit about that?
You know, for me, it still baffles me what exactly is considered cooling, what is considered a heating food, mm-hmm. a warm food. What I do take away from it, though, is that in Chinese medicine and the philosophy of eating in China, they believe that food is medicine,
mm-hmm.
that everything you eat has an impact on you, good or bad. And so you can draw a lot of, for example, that explains why they like certain delicacies that may not taste good to Westerners.
Mm-hmm. Could
but
you
they
name a couple?
Feel, oh, shark's fin, mm-hmm. Sea cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
They think that those delicacies, you know, they don't actually have much taste, to be honest. And I think most Chinese would admit that.
Mm-hmm.
And the textures put a lot of Americans off from those things. But they are very high in nutrition, mm-hmm. according to Chinese medicinal principles. And the cooling and heating thing is really a balance. You don't want to have too much too many hot foods,
mm-hmm.
or too many cold foods, and that you need to find your balance within that. And each person actually has either can mm-hmm. be either more hot or more cold, and you need to counter those elements in your own body.
Mm-hmm.
With,
no,
yeah.
go ahead. No,
oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, no, is that balance? Does one attempt to achieve that balance in each meal, or over the course of a day, or over the course of a week? Is it something you always think about?
No, I wouldn't say that it's something that's always on your mind. I would say that there are certain foods that that Chinese do point out as being extremely hot or extremely cold, and mm-hmm. things that you should stay away from. For example, lychees. My mother claims that if you eat too many lychees, you'll break out into pimples and have cold sores and all these things. And she really believes in this. And, you know, she says, you know, she loves lychees. I love lychees. And mm-hmm. but she'll say, you know, just eat a few at a time. Don't eat too many.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever noticed if that was true, if her fear was true or not?
I haven't noticed it
uh-huh.
exactly. And that's the hard part about Chinese medicine, of course, is that they think that things have long-term effects, so mm-hmm. that it might take a while for that to come about, or, you know, it just depends on what body type you are yourself.
Sure. Sort of long-term mm-hmm. and very, it seems very subtle.
Mm, very subtle.
Very subtle. I know a few people mm-hmm. who work in that area, and there's a subtlety and a delicacy. You know, it's not like take this pill and you'll feel better.
That's right. They don't believe in taking Tylenol to get rid of your headache.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They mm-hmm. approach it's an interesting approach. It's one that really intrigues me.
Mm-hmm.
So you're on your book tour.
Yes, I am.
You're getting married. Going on a lovely trip to Hawaii. When you return to Beijing, what will be next? Concentrating on your school, or is there another book we can think about?
Well, there's so many cuisines of China that that I would love to explore. There's the northwest of China that has delicious Muslim Chinese food. There's Yunnan province that I mentioned earlier in the southwest that is mm-hmm. very Thai-influenced food.
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many foods, and I'm not sure what my project will be, but I want to continue exploring and actually reading a lot about food in the next year to figure out what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about Muslim Chinese food?
Muslim Chinese food is absolutely delicious. It's most people don't realize that China, of course, borders Central Asia. And so, you know, you get a lot of Central Asian, almost Middle Eastern influence in the food out there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of cumin that's used.
Would there
used.
Be a lot of lamb in that area?
A lot of lamb, a lot of breads, baked breads, yogurt.
Yogurt. Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
So all of those things are very common. And in fact, actually, even in Beijing, yogurt is very common.
Mm-hmm. So you would find in the Muslim Chinese, you would find a lot of those flavors that we're familiar with from, you know, the
from
popularity.
Middle Eastern
yeah,
food.
From from Tunisian, Algerian, Lebanese, all that.
That's right.
And they have that sort of triumvirate of flavors.
Yes.
Lots of cilantro.
Yes, they use a lot of cilantro.
Cilantro, cumin, garlic,
cumin.
And lemon.
Mm-hmm. Not so much lemon, actually.
Uh-huh.
Not so much lemon, but they have a lot of fruit out there as well, and delicious fruits like the Hami melon, which is a cross between a cantaloupe and a watermelon.
Oh, wow.
It has
That's
the texture of a watermelon, but the flavor of a cantaloupe, and it's very, very sweet. And you can actually get them in Chinese markets in California.
And what's it called again?
Hami melon, H-A-M-I.
Melon.
Melon.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Absolutely delicious.
I love melons.
You can wrap it with prosciutto, and you've got a sort of a fusion dish right there.
Huh. That's interesting. What about Chinese agriculture as it relates to Chinese cuisine? Have you been able to explore that much?
Well, what's interesting is Chinese are basically only one generation removed from farms because the country is only urbanized in the past couple of decades. So you have people that are actually very aware of agriculture and farms and are, I think, more in touch with that part of life. You know, supermarkets have only come about in the past decade. So you have people who go shopping every day on a daily basis and who are aware of freshness and quality. And what I love about China, but what's also changing is, you know, there are a growing number of processed foods, and that didn't exist 10 years ago,
really?
20 years ago. Uh-huh. Yeah. And they eat a lot less. I think that's one of the reasons why Chinese are healthier than Americans, is that there isn't the same amount of chemicals and you know, manufactured food in China.
Is there resistance to its appearance and growing popularity?
To processed food?
Yes.
Yes. There is, you know, we haven't hit the TV dinners or the, you know, the frozen food yet, but I have a feeling that's going to happen.
Oh.
And then,
I guess every
know.
Culture has to go through it so they can finally then get rid of it.
Right, right. But as for now, you know, it's a culture of definitely eating fresh, lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, a lot of fresh meats, of course, and seafood. So hopefully those trends will stay. And that's something that I love about living in China, that you can get fresh fruit and vegetables very easily.
Mm-hmm. And do you see yourself spending a lot of time there?
Well, I've been there for 8 years
eight
now,
years,
so
wow.
It's been a long
yes,
time.
So. And you like it?
I love it. I have, you know, it's just great to be in a place that's dynamic, that's changing every day. We walk out of our home. It's a very urban environment, so it's very lively. And seeing, you know, the country change before our very eyes. You know, we got there in 2000, and you know, it's been amazing to see the changes in the architecture and fashion and food and every part of society, really. Yeah.
Well, interesting. Well, I wish you lots of luck both with the book. The book is Serve the People, A Stir-Fried Journey Through China by Jen Lin Liu. It is from Harcourt, and it's a nice hardcover at $24. It's a pretty long book for that. That's a good price. So lots of luck.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you have a wonderful time at your wedding and in Hawaii.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Coming up next is another great book review from Laura Hager. And you can meet me back here next week for another tasty episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour here on KRCB.
Broccoli and Other Tales of Food and Love by Laura Vapnyar is a collection of short stories united by four themes: the food and love of the title, that's the cheery part, and the darker thread of longing and loss. Vapnyar immigrated from Russia to America in 1994, and this deft little collection, small and pleasurable in the hand as McDuffie's reader, is an émigré's book, peopled with characters who've never recovered from the psychological displacement at the heart of the immigrant experience. The Russians in this book are obsessed with the food of their homeland. It becomes a touchstone, the only portable part of the country they've left behind. And yet, no matter how hard they try, the old family recipes made in America never quite turn out right. They never taste the same. Is it the quality or type of the vegetables, they wonder, or the massive number of substitutions each recipe requires? It's as if the recipes themselves are in transition, caught between worlds, just like the characters. Like the best short stories, at least the type of short stories I like, this collection is filled with sharply drawn characters who are as unpredictable and full of surprises as the plots of the stories themselves. In A Bunch of Broccoli on the Third Shelf, a lonely Russian immigrant who's never cooked asks a man over for dinner and then goes to a houseware store and buys everything she thinks she'll need. Pots, pans, bowls, whisks, spatulas, everything, it turns out, except the food. When her guest opens her refrigerator, all he finds is the eponymous bunch of broccoli, and they gamely go about making dinner out of that. In Luda and Milena, two older women vie for the heart of an elderly Russian man in their English as a second language class. Figuring that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, this seems to be a universal dictum, they compete by bringing ever more elaborate Russian dishes to class each week. I should probably have noticed the foreshadowing when both women began layering their recipes with extra helpings of butter and lard. In Borscht, a young Russian is working in America as a carpet layer to earn enough money to buy an apartment back in Moscow. He wants to go home, but his fiancée, the beneficiary of his remittances, keeps urging him to stay a little longer and send more money. Homesick and sexually frustrated, he seeks out a Russian prostitute in Brighton Beach, an aging immigrant who herself has spent her entire adult life in America sending money to her family back home. "I've bought three apartments," she tells him, as she cooks him a bowl of borscht in the kitchen of the cramped walk-up she shares with another immigrant. The descriptions of food in these stories are deft and detailed, but the real secret ingredient in Broccoli and other stories of food and love is the author's knowledge of the human heart. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.